back to MFA Writers. I'm your host, Jared McCormick. It is now October, which means MFA application season is right around the corner. The first application deadlines are now less than 2 months away, and to help potential applicants prepare, we're putting together a brand new application episode that will drop 2 weeks from today. In the meantime, we've got a re-release today of last year's episode featuring Lindsay Bernal. When you're done with it, be sure to check out our previous application-centered interviews with Katie Vishniak and Gregory Spatz, if you haven't already. You can find MFA Writers on Instagram and Twitter, as well as mfawriters.com. We love to hear from listeners, so feel free to shoot us a direct message on one of those platforms, or an email at mfawriterspodcast@gmail.com. And if you have a minute to rate or review the show, the best place to do that is on Apple Podcasts. Doing so will help boost our podcast as we try to boost these amazing writers. Also, if you or someone you know would like to be a guest on the show, you can apply at mfawriters.com. On that same website, you can also click the support button to support us financially, if it's within your means. Or you can do so by going directly to buymeacoffee.com/mfawriters. Finally, as always, thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoy the episode. Welcome to MFA Writers, the podcast where we talk to creative writing MFA students about their program, their process, and a piece they're working on. I'm your host, Jared McCormick. Today we've got our annual special episode on the MFA application process, and I'm super excited to be joined by Lindsay Bernal. Lindsay was born and raised in Rochester, New York, and holds a BA in English and Spanish from the University of Virginia, and an MFA in poetry from the University of Maryland, where she coordinates and teaches in the creative writing program and co-directs the Writers Here and Now reading series. Her first collection of poems, What It Doesn't Have to Do With, selected by Paul Guest as a winner of the National Poetry Series competition, was published by the University of Georgia Press in 2018. Lindsay, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks so much for having me.
So as I mentioned in your bio, you're a professor in the MFA program at the University of Maryland, and you told me that you are the admissions coordinator there, which is not a term I hear often in MFA programs. So tell us a bit about that position and what your primary responsibilities are.
Yeah, so, you know, the job of coordinating an MFA program, I think, tends to come with some work in admissions. So I have kind of a dual identity in my program. I teach creative writing courses, but I also administrate the program. So in terms of admissions, you know, I'm really the point person for prospective and active applicants. And I'm also, the point person for all of our MFA students who are enrolled in courses. And I think like that's really probably one of the most fulfilling parts of the job, or the part of the job that I really enjoy, because I get the opportunity to interface with emerging writers. And, you know, part of that is recruitment. You know, I'm sharing with them like what Maryland has to offer, but also like getting to know them, you know, hearing about their work. And it's a little bit like an extension of teaching too, just thinking about what their creative interests are. So anyways, you know, once I'm speaking to applicants who've been accepted, they are like faced with a really tough choice. Usually, if they've been accepted into Maryland, then they probably have offers elsewhere.
Right.
And as you know, the decision about where to get an MFA is so huge.
Yeah, right.
Because the work that we do in MFA programs, you know, it lasts beyond the degree. So the relationships that you cultivate in the MFA and the mentorship that happens like in the MFA, that continues long after the MFA. You know, I don't know if that answers the question, but I mean, I am, you know, one of the faces of the program in that process. And I do have the like perspective of having earned my MFA here. So I got my MFA And then I stepped into this job. And I think that that perspective, you know, has really allowed me to do the job with empathy, but also like with a commitment to transparency, which I think is so important in admissions. I mean, it's so important in graduate studies too.
Right, right.
But I mean, especially because it, you know, for applicants that are weighing decisions, it's nice to sort of have like straightforward information. And so I think that because I went here, you know, I feel like I've always sort of been like an advocate for the MFA students. And, you know, Maryland sort of has had a lot of changes, you know, since I was a student. You know, the big changes are that it's a fully funded program now. And, you know, they have the students have a guaranteed third year of funding too. And like the sequencing of the courses that they teach has changed. And the course load has changed. And I feel like, you know, I've been kind of a champion for all of those changes. So I've worked really hard with my colleagues to make them a reality. And I, you know, I think that I haven't really been afraid to like ask for better conditions for graduate students. And I think that's something that the applicants really need to think about is like, what's the climate? What's the culture? What's that going to be like in the school that you go to? So the other, you know, the recruitment phase of my job as the admissions coordinator, it takes up a lot of time. I mean, it's like, that's like late February to May is sort of like heavy into recruitment. And I imagine that other programs do this, you know, where you're having like conversations in Zooms with the accepted applicants and with the waitlisted applicants. I give like accepted and waitlisted applicants like the same, and I sort of give them the same opportunities to talk with me because things change so much on like the MFA program list, you know?
Yeah. And I imagine those conversations that you're having with people who've been accepted too, it's almost like a two-way interview, right? Because you're like trying to feel them out and see if they would be a right fit for the program. But you also like want to be transparent and like make sure that they're going to be happy in the program because community, I think, and culture in a program is so important.
Exactly. Exactly. And it's also just, it's such a stressful time. I mean, it's so exciting to have possibilities, like to be waitlisted or to get accepted, but it's also anxiety inducing too, because students don't want to, or prospective applicants don't want to choose the wrong program.
Yeah.
So I feel like that, those meetings and conversations and campus visits, you know, I even meet with them at AWP if it's like more convenient for them, if I am going. So it's just like having opportunities to sort of hear more about the programs that you've paid a lot of money to apply to.
So, you know, many MFA applicants hope after getting the MFA that they may one day be able to teach in a creative writing program, but we all know the market for teachers is a tough one. So how did you end up teaching at the program you graduated from?
Well, so just to clarify, I'm not tenure track, like, or tenured in my job. Teaching comes with the position. And I think that's the case in other programs too, with the coordinator or with the assistant director positions or the associate director positions. You know, I say that my position is unique, but there's a lot of programs where the person in this job attended the program.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess it's not that unique, but I've been teaching at Maryland almost every semester since I was a graduate student in fall of 2004, you know, in some capacity. And that's one thing about Maryland's program sort of being this large state school is that there are a lot of undergraduate creative writing courses. You know, the MFAs teach the like intro workshops, so the beginning poetry workshop, the beginning fiction workshop, and the multi-genre workshop. Those are all courses for them. And, you know, I've taught workshop at almost all the levels, including the MFA workshop. And I think, you know, I would say that at Maryland, the students get a ton of teaching experience. you know, they don't teach the first year, but then they start teaching creative writing in the second year. And then if they want to continue for a third year, it's optional, but guaranteed if they want it, they start teaching English 101 in the third year, in addition to workshop, usually. A lot of students graduate from the MFA these days and sort of aren't as interested in teaching. You know, I'm not sure if that's the case everywhere. Maybe it's because they've been in the classroom, you know, teaching a variety of things, but it's not like 100% of our graduates are, I would like to be an academic. You know, I think that they come to the MFA really to write, and they want funding, and the funding comes through teaching, and they may want to go on and teach in some capacity, but they may not. So I guess those conversations aren't happening as often as they used to. And maybe that's because, you know, students know the reality of the market.
Yeah. It's like a chicken or the egg situation, I think, because I think there are a lot of students going into MFA programs now who are changing their expectations before they even go, right? And knowing that, like, even if they wanted to get like a tenure track position in a creative writing program, it's just like, it's not going to happen unless you've published a couple books and you have like a lot of experience, right? It's just tough. So it's good to know the reality of the situation, right? And like be able to temper your expectations and to be able to think about, well, okay, is the MFA, are there other reasons that I want to get the MFA, right? Am I cool with doing this if it's just to improve my writing? Which, you know, for a lot of people, that's a great reason to get an MFA. So, and it's interesting to hear that you were hired as an admissions coordinator. So that was like your title. Oh,
so my title is academic coordinator.
Okay.
So it comes with admissions as part of that job.
Okay. Yeah. So that's interesting. So, I mean, it's always good, I think, for listeners to know like what other opportunities might be out there in academia. It might not be like a teaching position in an MFA program, like being hired as a tenure track teacher or professor. But if there are these positions like academic coordinator where you can also teach, if that's something you want to do, it's good to know about that.
I mean, I feel like it's really, if it is worth for any students that you're in touch with or those who are listening to the podcast, I think that looking on the job lists for some administrative jobs, if you want to stay in academia, I would say that, I mean, I wrote my thesis as a student, but like the real work post-thesis of writing my book came coordinating the program and teaching. You know, the schedule allows for creative work to happen in ways that, like, when you're teaching a lot, it's a little bit harder. At least it's harder for me. I can't imagine teaching like 3 or 4 courses a semester, which I know is also the reality of getting an academic job right now. A lot of them come with a lot of teaching.
Well, one thing I know a lot of listeners are anxious to figure out is whether or not they are a good candidate for an MFA program. So I'd like to go back a bit further and talk about your time before you were even a student in the MFA program, because I've heard a lot of professors and writers recommend taking some time off between undergrad and graduate school to gain some real world experience, which can be really helpful for your writing. As a 21-year-old, you actually moved to New York City without a job. Talk about real world experience. So is that something you would recommend?
Well, you know, the question that I feel like the most common question, I think, is like from my students, my undergraduates, and like, you know, just people who I'm talking with about MFA programs more generally, who I might not know, is about this real life experience, real world experience. And I feel like it's a really tough question because I think it's super individualized.
Yeah.
Like, it really does depend on the applicant. Like, I've encountered MFA students who come right out of undergrad and they're so much more developed as writers than I was, like, at 25 when I went to the MFA program. So for me, like, I didn't really have a choice. It wasn't like I wanted to move to New York without a job. Like, I didn't have a job, like, waiting for me. I decided on kind of a whim to move to New York. And I luckily got a job, but I didn't have a writing sample that would have led to me getting into an MFA program, you know, and I knew that. Like, I didn't start writing poetry or admitting that I even wanted to take a workshop until my, like, around my last year of college. So I took, like, the beginning poetry workshop as a senior in college. And, you know, I feel like I had some luck. That workshop was taught by then MFA student Jennifer Chang. And like, I learned so much from her, and that mentorship has continued. That friendship has continued. You know, she's one of my like primary readers still. Then I applied to take the intermediate workshop my last semester of college. And I had the luck of working with Rita Dove. And I feel like that gave me enough poetry to like apply for one thing so I could have one more workshop. So I got every poem I'd ever written in my life, I assembled and I applied for the Bucknell Seminar for Undergraduate Poets, and I got in by some miracle. And that was as vital to me as like all the time spent in New York. So I feel like that experience changed everything. And the peers, you know, my friends from that experience are like still part of my writing community. And so I think that for me, it was really about like figuring out how I was going to be able to write better poems. And I could have done that probably anywhere, but I did it in New York. And, you know, I was teaching in New York, having had no experience really as a teacher. I was teaching in public middle school in Brooklyn. I did that for only a year. And then I found like really cheap housing near where we had been teaching in Bay Ridge, which was like the last stop from like Manhattan in Brooklyn. And, you know, hence the fact it was affordable. And I cobbled together like part-time work that allowed me to have the mornings dedicated to writing. And I took workshops. You know, I did save money from teaching to take workshops at the 92nd Street Y. And from one of those workshops, like an offshoot of that workshop occurred where there was just a bunch of us who would meet every Tuesday and talk about poems. And we met for like 2 years straight every Tuesday with very little absence from that. I mean, it was like everybody showed up because I think we were all like trying to figure out how to write and how, and we didn't have enough money to do much else. So it was like that, you know, that was the most committed I was to a writing group. Like when I was age 22, 23, you know, we met all the time. And those writers I'm still, you know, I'm still in touch with. And so I think, you know, for me, I didn't have the material to apply. So that's why I did it. And I guess I gained real world experience, but it made me hungrier to be in an MFA program. You know, I was like, I needed to escape New York. I needed to get out of that life. I feel like I was trying to figure out like how to develop a writing practice while not like dying of alcohol poisoning. It was just like, I wasn't living my best life, but I was trying to read and write in the morning. But I knew that that life was not sustainable. And I really wanted to get into an MFA program. And it took me two times of applying to get in.
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. I completely agree that it is individual, because there are people that were in my program who were just out of undergrad who were amazing writers who were so far beyond like anything I could have hoped and dreamed to have been when I was their age. But like, I also came to writing late, and I'm glad you brought that up as well, because I think for some people, they see writers who have been writing like their whole life, like high school, undergrad, creative writing majors as undergrads. And they think maybe because they came to it later that like they won't be able to catch up or won't be able to get into an MFA program. That's the way I felt for a long time. But it just took me some years of being out on my own, like getting that quote unquote real world experience, which was really just finding a lifestyle that created space for me to like practice and get better at it before I could apply to MFA programs. So I completely agree. It's totally individualized. But it's always interesting to hear about the different paths that bring people to these programs.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's probably a little bit less burnout among the people who wait too. Cause I would say my friends who came in my program, who came right out of undergrad into the program, you know, some of them didn't have burnout at all, went on to PhD programs, but others like really like just wanted to take a break and maybe like weren't as excited about writing, you know, during the end of the program when it's most important to be like really excited because you're working on your thesis, because they didn't have any time away. They hadn't had it sort of taken away from them, which is what the real world does. You know, it's like you have to sort of fight for writing time.
So you said that when you were in New York, you really wanted to get into an MFA program. So like one of the things I've been asking guests this season is to tell me one way in which the MFA program has differed, either for better or for worse, from their expectations when applying. So thinking back, do you remember what you expected the MFA program to be like and what you would get out of the MFA program? And if so, how is the reality different for you?
I mean, like I said, that hunger that I had, it was so deep, and I think it was better like than I'd imagined. I don't know. I mean, I think that like I really love my time as an MFA student. You know, I've never left Maryland. So I graduated and then I stayed, and I wanted to like figure out a way that I could stay. You know, I came in July of 2004, and it's like October of 2022, and I'm pretty much like in the same space. I honestly, like, I didn't know a lot about Maryland's program, and I should have. Like, I should have known more about it. Like, I should have known more about the programs I applied to. Because I tell my students, you have to do all this research on the programs, but you know, I didn't do what I tell them to do. And so I got into three programs. So after my first time, I got into one unfunded program. I applied to five. Second time, I applied to 11 and I got into three. So I got rejected by eight programs. And I really had two choices. The third program I got into wasn't funded. I couldn't afford a program that wasn't funded. So I got into Maryland and I got into Montana, and I was really excited about both programs in terms of the work. Like I read the work by the poets who were teaching at both places, and I could see myself working with the faculty at both places. But in the end, you know, it was a matter of geography. Like I was in New York, I didn't have a car. And I think that I wasn't like brave enough to be like, I'm going to go all the way to Montana. Like it seemed like I could get from Brooklyn to Maryland really easily by train. And then I could like live without a car. And that was sadly like a big part of the decision. You know, sometimes I wonder like what kind of writer I would be had I gone to Montana, like if I'd been like brave enough to go like really far away. But I don't, you know, I don't have any regrets about the program that I went to. I mean, I should have known like how great the program was, and I didn't. I mean, and so I think that just the level of faculty attention is crazy. And the like friendships that I've made from this program, the alumni network, I mean, just everything. It's like, it's a really important part of my writing life now. I mean, I don't know what I would do without those mentors and readers.
It's always interesting for me to talk to people who have gone to MFA programs but have been out of them for several years, just to hear like that perspective. Like, you know, when you're looking back on it and thinking about like, you know, where you've come since the MFA program. I mean, now you're an award-winning poet, right? So like, in what ways, like when you look back on it, in what ways would you say that that program really put you on that path and made it possible for you to be the writer you are today?
I mean, I think it was everything that I like had to read. I would say the program was really challenging. I mean, it sort of like challenged me as a writer. The faculty were really involved in the writing, and they were, you know, constructively critical. And I think that it like, I learned how to like really work on a book. That was really part of that thesis year. It was like assembling a collection and writing the poems that fit into a collection, and then taking that like after the MFA, sort of continuing to work on it and write more poems. You know, I just feel like it's so hard to think about like what was the one thing like that made your book get taken or whatever. I mean, who knows? It took forever for my book to get taken. I wasn't going into the MFA to become an academic. I needed funding. Like I needed some kind of like, I needed to have a more stable situation, and I needed to be able to devote time to my own work where I didn't have to worry about another job. I mean, even though I was teaching, it was sort of connected, you know, in a way that my life didn't feel like, it felt like I had this one life as doing these part-time jobs. And then I would be, you know, struggling to find time to write. And here it was just so, there was so much support around the work. And like developing a real like belief in your work and in yourself as a writer. And again, like that's kind of, it's kind of abstract. I don't know how that's exactly cultivated. It's got to be in the teaching, you know, but I don't know exactly like at what moment I started to believe in myself as a writer, but it must have happened here.
All right. Well, let's get to some listener questions about the MFA application process. So over the last week, we've asked our listeners and followers on social media to send us any questions that they had for you. We did a similar thing last year with Gregory Spatz of Eastern Washington University, but he's a fiction professor. So we're hoping to get a glimpse into the poetry side of things this year. So do you mind answering some questions from listeners?
I'd love to.
Okay, cool.
I'd love to.
So when it comes to the writing sample, both Cecilia and Guadalupe wanted to know if it would be better to submit poems that deviate in style from one another to show range, or if it would be better to submit ones with similar styles to show focus.
I have kind of a boring like response to like writing sample. I feel like regardless of style, regardless of range, you should just send your best poems. And I know it's like hard as the writer of the poems to determine which ones are the best, but you just want to send the strongest poems you've ever written and put those 10 to 15 pages together. And I think that like respecting the page limit is like really the only rule. You know, there's not a kind of poem that like an admissions committee is looking for. You know, they're not. They're just like, they are going to be like awed by the sample if they're awed by it. And I feel like it's, you know, it's so subjective. I think asking your mentors and your peers like for some guidance with the writing sample is really useful, because it is so hard when you're in them. Just like when you're putting a book together, to know like, what are my best poems? And giving yourself enough time to allow for that, like kind of an editorial conversation with someone, like, what do you think of my writing sample? I tell my students to like, just get feedback on it.
So it would be very unlikely for someone who's like reading a writing sample to be like, oh, this poet's all over the place. These poems are all great, but they're just all over the place. So we don't want this person.
I feel like there could be the poet that whose poems are all over the place, and that's like what makes them so great. I mean, I can see myself being really excited by a sample that's all over the place. There is a degree of looking at potential in the writing sample. I mean, it's not going to be like that writing sample. You may never see those poems again beyond the application. You know what I mean? Like those are just getting you in, and you may never return to those poems that you applied. I don't know what I applied with. Those poems never became poems, but they got me into some MFA programs. And, you know, I think that the range question is always a tough one. I think you just want to send, the strongest poems you have and not worry so much about like cohesion or range.
Well, I think it's good to know that the people reading these applications, these writing samples, are aware of the fact that maybe like the poems that are in the application may not be anything like the poems that this person writes in the program.
I think that that's more often the case than not. And that by the end of the program, you might not even be able to recognize, like if you were to put the writing sample with the thesis, you wouldn't maybe know that that was even the same writer, because so many breakthroughs happen, I think, when you're an MFA student.
Yeah, I went back and read the story I applied with, and I was like, oh boy, I'm lucky I got in.
Yeah, I mean, I think that it's I do think that they're looking for that, and it's really hard to look for potential, but I think you know it when you see it.
Yeah, I mean, when I read that story, I was like, oh, there's some passages in here that are pretty good, that are interesting.
Yeah.
But like the story as a whole is like needed work. And I think that that's what happened, is the people reading my sample were like, there's some potential here.
They're definitely, it's not the same. Applying to an MFA program is not the same as sending that story
right
out for publication. And I think that's something else to consider too. I mean, it's like the writing sample, though it is your strongest work, depending on like where you are, as a writer, it's probably going to be imperfect, and it might be messy, you know, especially if you're like a wild, messy writer.
So this next question might kind of play off the last one a little bit, but we had a question from Marisha about the style of writing to include in the sample. And Marisha wants to know what you think of submitting collage style or segmented style writing as part of a writing sample.
I mean, I would go for segmented or collage. I mean, especially if you have both. Like, I think if the collage poem is one of your best poems, then put it in the sample. I mean, I think that it's not – I think the best MFA's programs are not looking for, like – they're not looking for a certain type of poem, a certain style. You just send the best poem.
And I think this applies, just so we're clear to listeners, this applies to fiction or nonfiction essays as
yeah.
well, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. I think you should be like a little bit wary of programs that are looking for a particular kind of poem or story. I mean, just because I don't know, you know, I think I would want to go to a program that didn't have like those kinds of designs on me. You know, like I would want, you know, I feel like you want to have the ability in the MFA program and throughout your life to sort of try out different things. I mean, that's part of the fun of being a writer.
I think that's an interesting point, because when I remember when I was applying to programs, I remember feeling like I had to show in my application that like I had a really clear idea of the kind of writer I was or wanted to be. But in reality, I just wanted to get into a program and experiment and figure out the kind of writer that I was going to be. So it's interesting to hear that like actually most or a lot of programs, at least in your opinion, would welcome that kind of blank slate coming in.
Yeah. I mean, I think that that's, I would also say that the faculty with whom I work, they're also like discovering who they are as a writer all the time. I mean, I think that's what you're doing when you're writing a story or a novel or a poem. I mean, I think that like every time you have that page in front of you, it becomes a space that you can kind of redefine yourself in it, you know, or you can sort of reinvent yourself.
Okay, so to me, both of these questions that we just had seem to be about taking risks. So I think applicants are hesitant to do anything too outside of the box with their writing samples because they're afraid to shoot themselves in the foot. Mm-hmm. But it sounds like you would encourage people to take risks in their writing sample.
I just think maybe it's just my opinion, but I think that if you're not taking a risk, then why are you writing the poem? What's the point of writing a safe poem? I mean, I feel like every time you write a poem, you should be taking some kind of risk. So that question was very easy, you know, cause it's like, yeah, do the risky poem. I mean, I feel like I'm always hesitant of like, if I write a poem and I think it's a safe poem, like that's probably not the best poem. Because my experience with writing poems are the ones that give you pause are usually the, you know, that are like, I'm a little bit unsteady or I don't know what I think about this poem. Those poems tend to be the better poems.
Why do you think that is? Do you think it just says something about the energy that you're bringing to it?
I don't know. I think it's also in, it's not just in the writing of the poem. That's also in what I read.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I don't like to read safe poems either.
All right. So we also got some questions about the statement of purpose. So D wants to know what an ideal statement of purpose looks like. So in other words, what makes a statement of purpose stand out?
This is a question I get a lot from my undergrads. And it's a tough question. Like, what makes one ready for an MFA program? So I feel like the one thing to keep in mind about the statement of purpose is it is not dismissed. You know, I think some people are like, I have a writing sample, it's great. And then it's like, I didn't really spend that much time on the statement of purpose, especially for poets. I mean, for fiction writers too, but it's like, okay, the statement of purpose becomes yet another opportunity to reveal yourself as a writer. And for poets, now you can write in prose. You have this really other opportunity. And I don't think there's not a template. I mean, I can't think of like, this is like the perfect statement of purpose. It's like, you know it when you see it. And I've seen so many standout statements of purpose, and I don't think that they have a lot in common. You know, I mean, I think they're all very different. You know, I think that if you can think of the statement of purpose as an exercise in like, your like why I write story. I mean, that's what you know, why are you a writer? You can read Joan Didion's Why I Write. You can read Joan Didion's On Keeping a Notebook. I feel like those are almost like statements of purpose. You can read Rebecca Solnit's A Field Guide to Getting Lost. You can read Maud Casey's, any chapter from Maud Casey's The Art of Mystery. Ross Gay's The Book of Delights. I feel like those are kind of like statements of purpose. And I think that that's kind of what the best ones are really thinking about. I think you're thinking about yourself as a writer.
Are there things people should include more, but often don't?
You know, it's so different. I feel like there's more of like a template for if you're applying to like a PhD program, there's particular elements like that you need to include in the statement of purpose that have to do with your research. And yes, you can include your research in a statement of purpose for the MFA program, but there's not really like a list of criteria. It's more, it's somewhat like an artist statement that you would write, you know, if you were applying for a grant or a residency. And it you know, it takes time. So I would just say like, that's something I always tell applicants is like, make sure that you give yourself, you know, months to put these materials together, because you want to have it and then you want to have time for someone to review it. And then you want to have time to make revisions and then maybe have another round of feedback on it, like you would a story or a poem.
Okay. So listener Bao Yuan wanted to know, what would you say is the most common mistake applicants make in a statement of purpose?
I think this is another strange part of the statement of purpose. I feel like it's like a compliment to the writing sample. So if you make a mistake in the statement of purpose, but the writing sample is so intriguing to the committee, they're not going to be like, oh, there was a mistake in the statement of purpose, so this candidate is now rejected. I don't think you should worry about that. I mean, obviously you should try not to make grammatical mistakes, but I don't think you should think of it like that. I think you should think of it as a compliment to the sample. You know, I think about other graduate programs where the writing sample is, you know, this sort of laborious thing for a student who's applying to like a computer science degree, maybe like to put together the sample or something that where maybe in their field they don't do a lot of writing. You know, as creative writers, this is the medium, you know? So it's like, just, I would say, I know that maybe the tone is like playful, but I feel like if you can sort of discover something while you're writing the sample, I think that's a sign of a good one. The sample and the statement. I mean, I feel like they're so connected.
Okay, so we had a couple questions about more general questions about the application. So Carissa had a question, not just related to the statement of purpose, but about the sample and about everything else that goes into your application. She wants to know, what are the markers of someone who is ready for an MFA? So what do you look for in an application that shows an applicant is ready?
There aren't I don't think there are markers in the application. I think there are markers within the self. So I would say that if you feel like you have to attend an MFA program and there's nothing else in the world that you would want to do, then you should apply to an MFA program. You know, that it's like, if you have no other choice and you feel that so deeply, then you should apply for an MFA program. Because what is it that you're doing in the MFA program? You're taking 2 to 4 years, depending on the program, to write. And you're dedicating that time to be a writer. And so, as we all know, many writers don't go to MFA programs. So you don't have to, you don't have to go to an MFA program to write. But if you feel like you need to go to an MFA program to sort of learn how to construct a life as a writer, then you should do it. And I think that there isn't a benchmark, for have I reached the moment where I can apply to an MFA program.
So what I'm hearing is, don't worry so much about showing in your application that you're ready for an MFA program. Just think about whether you actually want this, if this is actually what you want and what you need in this moment. And if you really want it, then that'll come through in the application.
Definitely. And it will come through in those two key pieces, in the writing, it will be there.
So Stephanie had a question that's maybe less about the application process and more about deciding where to go after you've gotten some acceptances. But I think it's a good question, and I was curious to hear what you think since you talk to a lot of students. So Stephanie asked, particular for BIPOC writers, what questions do you recommend people ask to find out if a program has true allies?
It's a great question. And I think it's a question that comes into the conversation now more than it did a decade ago. But I think it's a matter, again, it's a matter of doing the research on the program, via looking at websites, but also asking faculty, asking the academic coordinators or the assistant directors or the admin, asking, current students and alumni. One of the many great things about this moment is that it's easy to connect with a network, of alumni or current students via social media and programs like these. So I feel you have to ask the questions. Ask the questions what is the program doing to support anti-racism, to support access, to support equity, to support inclusion, to support social justice. And you just ask the people that, that are attending the program, ask the people that run the program, ask the people that teach in the program. And I think that you should know if these principles are also driving the curriculum in the program. Ask that question. If these principles are driving the hiring practices in the creative writing program, in the English department, ask if the program is committed to an anti-racist workshop model or anti-racist workshop models, and see what's happening behind the program. That might be harder in terms of getting information from, outside of an English department or outside of a creative writing program, but you can probably do that work on the web, looking at the larger university and what its initiatives are. So, I'd see departmental and university wide and in the in the off-campus community too, what public facing programming is happening. Is engagement and outreach in the community beyond the university a priority to the institution? And I just think that ask the questions, because students ask me the questions. That's something, or prospective students, and there will be answers if they care about these principles. And there will be a lot of work happening.
All right. The last question before I let you go is one I had. As we all know, MFA programs are really competitive, and every year more people will be rejected than can be accepted. It's just the nature of the business. And so I wanted to ask you about handling rejection. You mentioned this a little bit earlier, but your first collection of poems, What It Doesn't Have to Do With, you finished writing in 2012. And then, according to another interview I heard you do, you submitted it to about 25 contests a year for 4 years before it won the National Poetry Series competition. It was published by the University of Georgia Press in 2018, 6 years after you finished writing it. So what did you learn from that experience, and what advice do you have for anyone out there who may be facing rejection, either from an MFA program or from publications?
This is the sad reality, is that rejection is part of it. It's part of being an artist. And like, not getting into an MFA program might be the first rejection. You know, I know a lot of faculty here at Maryland who are writers with tons of awards didn't get into MFA programs the first time they applied. You know, as I've already mentioned, I did not get into an MFA program that I could attend, except one unfunded program, you know, my first time around. And then I got rejected by 8 programs, but got into 3. And I think that you just, it's a cliche, but like, developing the thick skin matters. And my advice is, you have to cultivate 2 selves. So there's like the number one self. The number one self is your self writing. Okay. That's the sacred self. That's like the joy. The joy is writing. Then, and it's the far inferior second self is like the one who applies to programs, to residencies, to awards, to book contests, sends their stories out, sends their poems out. That's like this other version. And you have to separate the art from the biz. And I feel like in some ways the MFA program is part of the biz. You know, it's part of, it's part of an institution. You know, you're kind of cheap labor for a graduate program. I mean, that's part of something else. And you have to do that. At least I've had to do that sort of division of myself to get through the rejection. And I think that, I don't know. I think that book must have been sent out 6 years. Cause I think I did start sending it out in 2012. I think there were a couple of contests, and I don't know if I can, I mean, if it's 25, it's like hundreds and hundreds of rejection letters. And it's really painful to put that much time into something, to spend 5 years writing something plus your MFA and have it be rejected that many times. But there's detachment. You have to study detachment from it. And it's so hard and it's so painful. And I think that I was about ready to give up on that book. I mean, I was going to put it away and I was going to start the next book. And then it won the National Poetry Series, you know, after having been rejected from the National Poetry Series like 4 to 5 times. So you have to write through the acceptances and you have to write through the rejections. And I'm not saying that like winning things and getting published doesn't bring joy, but it doesn't bring as much joy as like finishing a poem. And I think that you got to keep writing. And that's like the important part. And keep that flame burning, because the writing, not the publication, not the prize, the writing is what keeps me going. And that's what brings me joy.
Lindsay, this has been fantastic. Thank you so much for stopping by and chatting with me.
I loved it.
Well, thanks so much.
Thank you.